In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
We explore the vision of Peter Norbeck and the vision of Donald Trump. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, August 27th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, today is Peter Norbeck Day. Norbeck was governor of South Dakota. He represented the state in the U.S. Senate as well. But he also planned and surveyed some of the state's iconic scenic byways. Today we'll talk about a proposed National Garden of Heroes funded in President Trump's signature domestic legislation. What would it mean if the patriotic sculpture garden comes to the Black Hills? We also welcome Marty Jackley for a look at why he wants South Dakotans to send him to Washington, plus the details of the South Dakota Highway Patrol's partnership with ICE and how the Secretary of Public Safety intends to use his authority. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Earlier this summer, South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley announced his candidacy for Congress. The seat is currently held by Representative Dusty Johnson, who is running for governor. Jackley joined me in the Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls to outline his platform. Marty Jackley, welcome back to the In the Moment studios. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You are running for the U.S. House of Representatives now. In addition to your job as South Dakota's Attorney General, this is a new role you want to take on. Tell us why.
I look at the fight as in Washington. We have such a great opportunity right now in our country to be making a difference, an opportunity to address the border, strengthen national security, hold government accountable. The things that I've done as Attorney General, I just simply want to continue on in Washington. I'm excited about that opportunity. The campaign's going amazing. I'm out and about talking to citizens at fairs, at parades, at events. The support has been overwhelming, and I'm having a fun time on the campaign so far.
You're having a fun time so far.
I am. I love going and talking to the people, and it helps me, frankly, be a better attorney general. I'm able to be in various communities, talk about what law enforcement's doing, what we can do more of, listen to concerns, hear about what South Dakotans want in Washington. And I'm hearing about a variety of different issues. Agriculture, of course, I own a farm and a ranch. I've been active on the product of the USA labeling. I hear a lot about energy and commerce. I'm an electrical engineer, so those are conversations I'm enjoying having. And again, oftentimes the conversation goes back to the southern border, the desire that everybody wants that border shut down, and they want the drugs to stop coming through, and they want a reasonable immigration policy out of Washington. They want a policy that recognizes you have to earn citizenship. They want a policy that recognizes, though, through the visa process, we do need workers. We do need to have student visas for kids willing to further their education. We need to have a federal system and E-Verify and other things that work. It's too slow, it's too government, and there's a need to put in place a comprehensive, effective immigration policy in our country.
So what are you hearing them say, the people in South Dakota that you're shaking hands with now or sitting around the kitchen table? What are you hearing them say about the southern border? Because are they feeling confident that the problem has been moving toward the solution that they like? Are they uncomfortable with how the solution is being implemented? Are they fearful for the future of how the solution could be implemented and the rule of law? What are they unpacking with you? Or do they have a very simple, like, hey, shut down that border, Jackley, and you've got my vote? How nuanced is it? I know I asked you like 10 questions in a row right there, but what I'm really getting at is the big question of how nuanced is the understanding of South Dakotans about the southern border?
I feel on its surface, South Dakotans want to see that southern border closed. They've seen the drugs pouring into our states. They've seen the meth, the fentanyl. They've seen the gun trade. They've seen the violent crime. They want that to stop. I think there's a general feeling it has stopped, which then really brings us to the next stage, and that is, what should comprehensive immigration policy look like? I recognize that the visa program is very important. It's important for agriculture. It's important for tourism. And again, I go back to the student visas. That program needs revisions. It needs to be more reasonable. And really, it needs to be more responsive to the needs of the workforce, and it hasn't been. It has been a broken policy for the last several years. It is, I think, improving, but it needs a shot in the arm, and it needs some responsible rules put in place to how do you earn citizenship, how do you earn the ability to have a visa. And if you take steps that violate the law, and I've said this with 287G, you know, we have authority now if somebody's here either illegally or they're here on a visa and they commit a violent crime or a drug crime, they need to go back to their country.
I talked to current U.S. House of Representatives Dusty Johnson about people whose only offense is crossing the border without permission, and if there is a pathway to citizenship for those people, or if all those people need to be removed from the country. He said there wasn't a lot of political appetite for amnesty, and yet there's also, I think I'm hearing a lot of people who are upset with, if that is the only offense, that there used to be in the immigration code a pathway for those people. Where are you coming down on that for people whose only offense is crossing without permission?
So as Attorney General and as a candidate for Congress, I do not support amnesty. Too many people have had to earn that right. There are other pathways and solutions. And for me, it's the visa process. They have the ability and discretion to be able to issue visas. So they're able to look at individual circumstances, and if somebody can become eligible and legally go through that process of visas, they should be allowed to. But it's not right. It's not fair to just do amnesty. And that was all but occurring under prior administrations. I don't feel that is the current appetite for the public. I don't think it's fair, and I wouldn't support outright amnesty.
So what do farmers and ranchers want when it comes to the visa program for workers?
They want a responsive federal process. I see it all too often as I travel the state. I've experienced it as Attorney General. I had a situation once where we had invested in a firearms expert from South Africa, and the federal government couldn't get its act together, and that person had to go back home after all the training just because they couldn't do a simple process of a verification. That system's broke. The federal government needs to have a process that is meaningful, that whether it's E-Verify or some other process, to be able to look at an individual and say, should they have a visa and how long should that visa be? That program, in my opinion, has been broken, having experienced it as Attorney General, having seen it in the agricultural community, the tourism community, and even at times for material witnesses. When I was United States Attorney and somebody I needed, I couldn't get them through that process. If there's a problem with the process, the federal government needs to evaluate how do we improve that process and make it happen instead of just talking about it.
What are people telling you in the smaller towns of South Dakota about tariffs and how they're impacting us? And what message would you bring to Washington regarding tariffs?
Generally, I think most people feel that they don't like tariffs, they don't like inflation. You have to recognize that some countries are putting things in place, and I support to the extent I don't generally support tariffs, but if we have to have them, I feel they need to be fair and equal. That process is going on right now. But generally speaking, I mean, tariffs are always a concern, and how you implement them in trying to make trade fair is important. And that I would support a comprehensive plan that tried to minimize or limit tariffs and only use them in circumstances when we need them as a matter of fairness.
What are you seeing about the federal government in general, especially from your vantage point as Attorney General, which I think would be really interesting to hear? We know there are massive numbers of layoffs of federal employees across departments. Is this a right sizing, in your opinion, of federal government, or are there things that need to be backfilled because too much was done in the wrong places and it needs to be more nuanced?
Well, certainly DOGE has been busy at work, that there is a balancing going on. And whenever you do a balancing, you don't always get it right. I mean, the important thing is when you come into an office, you make decisions, you evaluate that decisions, and you have to sometimes change course. I've had to do that as Attorney General. When I came in back last time after an impeachment process, it was a different office than I left. And so I had to make immediate decisions. But I think a good leader is willing to sit down and once you've made a decision, reevaluate that, and sometimes change direction. Some of that is occurring now. I mean, I look at the law enforcement side, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI. Those are very important partners. I mean, we just ran an operation in Sturgis, a joint operation, and we need those resources. So, you know, it's going to depend upon the circumstances. I have a frustration. I think everybody does. The IRS is broken. The immigration policy is broken. So somewhere there had to be a change. And hopefully they will get their arms around that and make a decision where resources need to go, but fix the problem.
So if people send you to Washington, what kind of committee assignments would you seek? What do you think your priorities should be for the state?
Some of that, of course, will depend upon whether Republicans hold the majority. That will give me more opportunities. I'm blessed with having been chairman of the AGs. Several AGs are congressmen and senators. I've reached out to them. I will certainly be relying upon their assistance and their advice. But a couple of the committees that I'm looking to, of course, agriculture. I have a farm and a ranch. I recognize the importance of agriculture in South Dakota. I think I have something to offer there. I'm also an electrical engineer, and energy and commerce is something important to our state. There's additional opportunities there. And then judiciary. I've been U.S. attorney. I've been attorney general. I've been a state's attorney in two counties. I feel I would have something to offer on judiciary. They do important work to keep our country safe. So those would be three committees that would be important to me. But whether or not Republicans hold the majority will decide how many committees I'm on and how high up I reach in those committees. Yeah.
Just about everybody who runs for office says they have a farm or a ranch. Tell us about your operation.
Sure. So I'm blessed. I should say I have half of a family farm. I have a great little sis that, of course, you know, operates and has half of that. So growing up in Sturgis, our family farm would be about 20 minutes from Sturgis by a little town called Vail, South Dakota. I have to say that so people don't think I'm rich and from Colorado. A few years back, I had an opportunity, and I missed the farm. To buy 1,200 acres by pier, and so I bought a ranch. It has some crop ground on it. And then more recently, one of my neighbors at the home place approached three of us and said they were ready to sell their property. And so I went in with three of my neighbors to purchase a little land on the Bell River, about 3/4 of a mile of the Bell River. It's my vacation to get away and ranch and farm. I miss it. But as I'm serving as Attorney General, I'm running for Congress, and I'm still trying to be the best dad I can be. I don't get to spend as much time on the farm and ranch as I like.
Yeah. Everybody's been talking about the list of supporters and donors who came to support you and show that they were behind you. Tell us a little bit about what you're hearing from. I guess what I'm getting at here with this question is the Republican Party in South Dakota is not a monolith. It's not a unified party. It's made up of individual people who have different ideas about what the future of the party should be. So you're not only hearing from the everyday South Dakotan at the kitchen table, you're also hearing from big business owners and, you know, leaders in the medical field and people who are writing checks, and they are all going to have access to you to say, this is what we want you to bring to Washington. What are you hearing from them that you find intriguing?
One of the things that I've enjoyed, and I think it's through hard work and the way I've operated as Attorney General, is widespread support from conservatives and moderates. I mean, everybody knows I'm conservative, but for instance, last night in Sioux Falls, we held what I understand is the largest fundraiser ever in South Dakota. We had 205 host couples. It was an extraordinary night, and I credit those host couples with bringing their friends. But on that list were moderates and conservatives, because they know while I'm conservative, I'll listen. I'll be a reasonable conservative. And really, as Attorney General, I've supported the issues that they like, and they want to see more of that. And that widespread support hasn't just been in Sioux Falls. It was at our Rapid City event. We're about to enjoy it Thursday night in Watertown, and we move forward to Mitchell, Sturgis, Brookings. And I'm hearing the same thing. We want you to be the type of congressman you've been as Attorney General. You're our lone congressman. We want you to stay conservative. Don't leave your principles, but listen, work hard, form relationships. One thing you'll never hear me say is I'm just one of 435. I couldn't get something done. You've seen me as Attorney General be chairman of the Attorney Generals. I'm currently vice chairman. I plan on being a leader. I plan on utilizing the relationships with Republicans and Democrats that I've served with previously if I'm blessed with the opportunity to go to Washington.
What's your status on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting or the future of public broadcasting in South Dakota and across the country?
Public broadcasting has been very important to me as Attorney General public safety. We rely on public broadcasting for a variety of important reasons, whether it's an Amber Alert, getting the news out if we need it for public safety. So I've always been supportive. I recognize there's an ongoing issue more on the national level, but when it comes to here in South Dakota in public broadcasting, it's been an important partner. It's something that I've supported because, again, it helps me better do my job. If there's an emergency situation, I can rely on public broadcasting to broadcast to citizens if we need them to stay in their homes, if we need them to look for that little girl that's missing. And that's important to me.
Any other things you want to let listeners know? I'm sure we'll talk again in the future about your campaign, but as an introduction, anything that they don't know about you that through other campaigns you think people might want to know about you as a candidate?
I think the biggest thing is I enjoy South Dakota. I enjoy the opportunity to campaign, to crisscross the state, get new ideas, and I'm just having the time of my life.
Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota, the state of statues, may soon get some additions to our marble and granite faces. Seth Tupper spotted the funding for a statue garden in the so-called One Beautiful Bill. Tupper is editor-in-chief of South Dakota Searchlight. Brad Murdoch-Jurgensen is co-host of the Dakota Town Hall podcast and executive producer of the Rapid City Post. They join me in SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City.
Well, yeah, I only look at the important stuff, obviously, in the big, beautiful bill, you know, and, you know, I scrolled past all the stuff about, you know, Medicaid and, you know, all the important. And I got to the really important stuff, which was, you know, statue garden.
Now we're talking.
But, you know, people might remember as background when Donald Trump was out here in 2020 at Mount Rushmore and had the fireworks show during the speech that he gave. He introduced this idea that we should have a national garden of American heroes, or statue garden. And so there was speculation then that, you know, might that be in the Black Hills since he announced it here. And, you know, a lot of water under the bridge since then. It never happened, but he's revived the idea. And it turns out there's $40 million for statue procurement for the Garden of American Heroes in the big, beautiful bill. And, you know, sort of parallel with that, stretching back a few years, the NOM and then the Roden administration have been active proposing that be built on land in the Black Hills about a mile or two as the crow flies from Mount Rushmore that's privately owned by the Lean family out here in the Black Hills that is apparently willing to donate the land for it. And, you know, there's it's kind of it splits people on whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, but, you know, when you look at Trump's executive orders on this, he has listed names in the executive orders of people who should be honored with statues, and there are some logical ones.
Here's where we're going to lose everybody.
Well, there's, you know, Martin Luther King Jr., Paul Revere, you know, Harriet Tubman. But then you get to names, Kobe Bryant, Julia Child, Whitney Houston.
I'm for Julia Child.
Alex Trebek. It's a little bizarre. And so I wrote a commentary on this just saying, you know, the other aspect of it for me is it would be along Iron Mountain Road in a area that's undeveloped and very quiet and natural right now. And this would be a pretty giant disruption of that area and unplanned to just sort of plop down, you know, 50 statues and a giant parking lot that would be required for something like that. And then the plan that the Leans had drawn up even includes a tramway to tram people between Rushmore and this site. And so, yeah, it's all out there, whether it's going to happen or not. And this, you know, who knows at this point for an idea that's been around for 5 years already that still hasn't happened. So,
yeah. Before we're going to dive into this idea of this question of why statues and why South Dakota, like what is our relationship with statuary and public art in just a minute. And we're definitely going to dive into where this money is coming from and what else it might have been earmarked for before. I want to make sure we touch on two other points that you wrote about in this column. Seth, a little history lesson about Dennis Dugard, governor of South Dakota, and a little history lesson about Peter Norbeck.
You'll have to remind me what the Dugard reference
Spearfish
was.
Cannon.
Yes.
Because I thought
yes.
the same thing. You said Dugard, and I was like, what did Governor Dugard?
Exactly.
And it was Spearfish Canyon. And I went, oh, yes, Seth Tupper remembers Dennis Dugard running a state park in Spearfish Canyon.
Seth Tupper remembers after Lori Ross reminds him.
The new show after In the Moment.
But, yes, but, you know, part of my thoughts on this are really informed by, you know, I grew up East River, and I'm a, you know, Black Hills transplant. And, you know, a number of years ago when Governor Dennis Dugard was governor, he proposed making a state park in Spearfish Canyon. Mm-hmm. And I kind of thought, as he thought, apparently, and a lot of people thought, East River, oh, great, you know, let's protect Spearfish Canyon. Well, but there was a quite large backlash against that in the Black Hills, where a lot of people said, you know, we don't want Spearfish Canyon to become Custer State Park. We don't want hundreds of thousands of people streaming in and out and more development and trash and sewage and that we got to manage and all that. We kind of like the old Spearfish Canyon that was a little bit undeveloped. And there was a strain of rhetoric about that and a real pushback against that idea, and it fell apart. And there is not a state park in Spearfish Canyon today.
And now they're going to put a gold mine out there, so where'd that get you?
Right. And so that has always informed I've always noticed that. And there's been other examples of that, but there are people from East River or national politicians who think something's a great idea for the Black Hills, and people in the Black Hills say, yeah, we're not so sure about that.
Listen, you guys take Trump's name out of this thing. This statue idea passes by like 60-something percent. It's not just because we're not good at coming up with what else should be art to South Dakotans. I think we're being too hard on statues. If anything, let's expand our horizon on what could be art. I think we pick statues because statues are the easy art to pick as a state. No, I don't think we're – are we statue crazier than Iowa?
Oh.
I think so.
You think
so? Yeah. I do.
Yeah. I think so. I mean – Iowa, please give me a call in the moment at sdpb.org. You have until October 31st to send this email and let us know whether you have Mount Rushmore, Dignity, the Ark of Dreams, the Trail of Governors, and the City of Presidents. If Iowa has those things or has something that would be comparable to that.
Listen, if we didn't have some of these things, it'd be down to the Corn Palace, all respect
Sculpture
to Mitchell.
Walk? That's, I forgot Sculpture Walk. No, I mean, Mount Rushmore, Crazy Horse.
Well, let's not forget, before they did Mount Rushmore, the original idea was to carve the needles into, statues of people. That was the original idea for that. So
edit that out.
Let's not give anybody any ideas. But
The other thing I think I need to edit out of your column is the phrase, Big Beautiful Black Hills. Don't let that catch on. That's going to be a thing.
No.
Well, and to circle back to your question, the other thing about Peter Norbeck, you know, as people may know, legendary South Dakota governor, senator, instrumental in the carving Mount Rushmore, the founding Custer State Park. He also personally traipsed and rode horseback through the Black Hills to survey the route for Iron Mountain Road and to make it as unobtrusive into nature as possible. And that's part of the reason why it's so winding and everything. And this would be this proposed location for the statue garden would be plopped right alongside Iron Mountain Road, and would really disrupt the plan for that road and the pains that were taken to preserve nature and to be as unobtrusive to nature as possible with that route.
Yeah. All right, so back to Murdoch's point. Why is South Dakota so into public art, specifically public art that looks like a sculpture?
Or I don't know if that's my question. I don't know if I agree with you guys.
Okay.
I think, doesn't every state have a thing? Shouldn't you want to, like, you know, you want the Capitol to be a, how do you think you get new future nerds to get into politics? They visit the Capitol and it's neat. And, if, you know, again, respectfully to peer, if you don't walleye fish or deer hunt or work in the government, Pier's a hard pitch. Why not throw art and gardens and statue walks and stuff? There's not much else to do there.
You have great community theater.
Okay, I'll give you that.
A really good kitchen store. Some outstanding restaurants.
I'm not sure.
And some really fine people.
I don't see a lot of East River, you know what I mean? The Empire Mall don't make it in our tourism ads. There's a reason people come out here.
Right.
Well, I think that's part of it. You know, when you go back decades in South Dakota being sort of off the national map and needing to draw people out here somehow. It's gimmicks, you know. Let's the Corn Palace statues.
Yeah.
You know, let's carve a mountain. Let, you know,
Wall drug.
It's sort of our history as a state is needing a gimmick to get people out here. To also, then enjoy the
America's
the
turning 250, so everyone just buckle up and get used to some bunting and buy some now, because it like the local monster truck show next year is going to be America's monster truck show, and we are like it or not, which you should like, a premier destination for these centennials and events because we should be right, and so like I don't know, I think it's rad.
But the tension is, as I tried to point out in my column, the trick is. How much is too much, and what's the balance?
I totally agree.
Right. And where does it go? Yeah.
And I don't love this current version of it, where with Trump there's going to be a sponsored by McDonald's or a Hulk Hogan statue or whatever is going to come with it. Right. Like, that's a drag. But,
and I think,
you know,
and
we got to get through it.
Seth Collin points out two really good things. And we know we have a really influential president who can, I mean, if it's in the bill, it's almost like, well, it's going to happen, and it's going to be next week. The submissions for these statues were due July 1st of this year. So people possibly have already... you know, applied and are making their plans for this. But Seth brings up two really important points. And one is, I think, the people of South Dakota, with him mentioning Spearfish Canyon Project, that really saw a lot of pushback. So Governor Larry Roden could see a similar kind of pushback from the people of South Dakota, especially people who live in the Black Hills. And the second thing is, you know, the legacy of Peter Norbeck and walking that space and seeing what it should look like. Are we really ready to redevelop that in an era where development of any kind of infrastructure development, which we'll get to in the second part of our conversation today when we talk about water, any kind of development is under high scrutiny right now, including, I would think, a new attraction that would take up landscape footprint in the Black Hills, in the big, beautiful Black Hills of South Dakota. I don't know that it's a done deal. I like what Seth wrote. I'm going to go on Team Seth on this one, Murdoch.
I'm always on Team Seth, really. Top rope, tupper, baby.
And I could tell you, Lori, I mean, I already have, you know, since I wrote that column, there's a little cabal of people of the Black Hills who are emailing me constantly about this now, and even to the point where somebody shot aerial photos of this. And they're watching it and what's going on, you know. And so, I mean, yeah, there are people who are ready to oppose this. Now, you know, in this new era here, you know, in the first Trump era, it was a, you know, crazy idea, whatever, didn't happen. Now, as you pointed out, it feels more like, you know, hey, with the people Trump has in place and what, you know, what he's been able to do this term, it feels like we could wake up tomorrow and the statues might be out there already.
Right. Well, and that's where the super Trumpers, to that point, kind of, where are the super, you know, the people that are like, everything he says is gold, let's go for it. But they're against... you know, development in South Dakota in this little Venn diagram I'm building. Where do they, which side of the magnet will pull to them the hardest? The anti-development or the need to be on the
Trump
team? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
The desire for patriotic sculptures or the desire to have this not be in our backyard?
Listen, there's another pit. There's another bowling ball that it's not either or. I'm saying there's a middle ground. It don't have to be the McDonald's statue that's out by the, you know, off the interstate there. This could be done with taste, people.
Well, they have to be done in a realistic design. So no abstract sculptures.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. Up to $200,000 per statue. This is, I'm going back to April 24th when the National Endowment for the Humanities did a press release about this, seeking applicants. And the deadline for application then was July 1st, which we have passed. And they were referencing President Trump's Executive Order 13978. It had a list of names, as Seth mentioned, historical figures, including those approved by President Trump's executive order. And at the time, I reached out to the National Endowments of Humanities because our state Humanities Council had been completely defunded and had all their federal funding removed. And then shortly after that, this press release was issued. And at the time, I asked the question, did you just move South Dakota and other states' funding to this project? And I did get a response from their communications director and said, no, this is not a transfer. I think the direct quote was, the $17 million NEH is committed to the Garden of Heroes project, matched by $17 million from the National Endowment for Arts. comes from the fiscal year 2025 congressional appropriations of $207 million as directed by that executive order, not from repurposing any of the funds from grant projects that DOGE terminated. And that was the statement that I had gotten at the time. Reached out to Dusty Johnson's office. He said he thought that the garden should be privately funded. I haven't checked with him since April, because obviously his lot has changed since April as far as what he votes for funding and whatnot. So I should probably follow up on that. But the State Humanities Council, were they here, would definitely want us to say this is money that, or this is at least equal to money that was taken away from us for these South Dakota programs. So $200,000 for one statue is roughly equivalent to 1,000 humanities scholars programs in the state,
South Dakota.
Which aren't happening right now because they've been cut. 3 years of the Young Book Program for readers for one statue would equal that, which is giving out, you know, Wings of an Eagle by Billy Mills right now. So they would have, you know, a different look at this as far as how this is being funded. So it's complicated.
Lori, we need a statue of Alex Trebek in the Black Hills. I mean, really. it's just the fact that we don't
mandatory.
Have that.
Well, that's not mandatory. If an artist said, I want to, you know, then it could be approved, but it could not. That was just a suggestion of possible American heroes.
Yeah.
Doc, how do you define hero?
Oh,
American hero, go.
With time. That's how you define it, with time.
Well, and that
is a beautiful answer.
That is part of the broader argument to contextualize this. If you remember when Trump gave his speech at Rushmore in 2020, his speech was all about, you know, the context then was folks were tearing down statues of Confederate war heroes in the South.
Right.
And we were having this national moment about, you know, our history and things like that. And his speech was about, you know, he went to Mount Rushmore partly because, you know, this, he wanted to, you know, protect what he sees as, you know, his idea of history, and we shouldn't be tearing down monuments to our history and things like that. So I mean, yeah, the idea of who we might memorialize in the statue garden also, it could get really controversial.
Yeah,
and
what
really
could go wrong?
Yes.
Could go wrong. However, you finding it in the Big Beautiful Bill would be an indication that this is a priority for this administration. And I think, as we said earlier in this conversation, with the 250th coming up, they're definitely looking for, everybody's looking for ways to celebrate America at 250. Mm-hmm. And this might end up being something that moves forward kind of quickly.
Yep. And it could be something else that we never hear about again, too. I don't know why.
I think
that's
so.
True.
100% true.
Move on to meme coins or whatever's next, you know?
Yep.
I did want to add before we move on to the next thing, which is the City of Presidents Project. I did this reporting back in April. I haven't updated it since then, but each of those statues from private funding is around $50,000. Statues along Pierce Trail of Governors is around $72,000 to create and install. And South Dakota's Trail of Governors works with the Community Foundation to manage donations. So,
and Murdoch could weigh in on this, but I saw some national coverage about the statue of Trump's proposed statue garden too, which is kind of funny. Which was don't like the president's statues in Rapid City. Don't they each take like 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, they take a while.
So can you imagine how long it's going to take to make 250 statues?
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's why the price is up there. You know, you pay express shipping. they're gonna two-day it.
If you're a foundry, send me an email in the moment at sdpb.org. That's Seth Tupper, editor-in-chief of South Dakota Searchlight, and Brad Murdoch-Jurgensen, co-host of the Dakota Town Hall podcast. He's also executive producer of the Rapid City Post. Now, that's just the first half of our conversation. We'll bring you the second half next week. You can find our full conversation and more, as always, on SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies podcast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The 287G program delegates specific immigration enforcement duties to state and local law enforcement agencies. That's only if the agencies enter into a partnership agreement with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. We've spoken with Attorney General Marty Jackley about what that means for South Dakota's Division of Criminal Investigation, or DCI. And we've also talked with Minnehaha County Sheriff Mike Milstead about what that means for his deputies in the field and in the jail. You can find those conversations online at sdpb.org/news. Now we are going to loop in the South Dakota Highway Patrol. Bob Perry is the South Dakota Public Safety Secretary. He joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls.
We are certainly different than what DCI or the Sheriff's Office, different than them and different. We will use the program in different ways. Mm-hmm. So first of all, historically, we've seen an issue where if we stop someone who is here illegally, it has been very difficult, especially if they have a criminal background. Almost always, if they have a criminal background, we're very concerned that we don't like to just let them go. But historically, it's been difficult because, as you're probably aware, there's only so many ICE and HSI agents in the state. So there was only so much opportunity for them to respond and really do anything about those that we would come across. So this program will allow us to assist them in those efforts. So, well, I was going to say once all the troopers are trained, but they all are trained right now, the five we have trained. It'll allow them to take those next steps that making it reducing the need for ICE to respond to a scene. So historically, local, state, county law enforcement doesn't necessarily have authority to deal with illegal immigration. This training and this task force model gives those troopers who are trained a little more authority. For instance, they could physically take them into custody themselves and put a detainer on them at the local jail, wherever they're taking them to, without the need for ICE to respond. Now, that doesn't mean that ICE does not get involved. They still have to reach out to an ICE agent or HSI to get guidance. Trained or not, they still need guidance and direction from various members of the Office of Homeland Security.
Yeah. All right. You said five officers?
Five, yes.
Five troopers, both sides of the state?
Two east, two west, one central.
And what was the training like? How long was it? And what sort of things did they learn about immigration law?
Sure. The training is a 40-hour online class. I didn't take it myself, but I have talked to the troopers who have. It starts off with a little bit of history about immigration issues, I guess is how I'll refer to it. It talks, then moves into the 287G program, what it is, how it works. And then it goes into the actual training part. And a couple of the highlights that I want to share are, one, it makes sure it provides training about profiling, how that it should not be used as a method to profile certain individuals, whether it's the color of their skin or their accent. It trains you not to do that, I guess it would be the best way to say it. That does away with the profiling, or we hope that trains troopers not, you know, I'm certain they won't use it for profiling, but the training is there for that. So then when you do come across someone who you suspect may be illegal, it gives you steps to build reasonable suspicion. You just can't stop someone who has a Spanish accent or Chinese accent, whatever the case may be, or can't speak English even, and assume that they're illegal and ask them that question. You have to build reasonable suspicion to follow that investigative path.
Okay. To ask.
To ask.
Correct. So right now you can't. So what is it before for the troopers who are not part, mm-hmm. as you do not have the authority or haven't been trained, and they pull somebody over? I'm sure you already have training about profiling.
Yes.
And you would
already
have.
I just wanted to add that it was specific in the 287G program
right,
as well.
Right. So what is the process if somebody accuses a highway patrol officer of profiling them? Is there a complaint process in place already?
Sure. There are two methods to make a complaint against any law enforcement officer. One through their agency, the Highway Patrol, and then through the Law Enforcement Standards and Training Commission.
Okay. So then we're at this idea of when you can ask and when you cannot ask. And I think this is important for citizens to understand, too, when they have to answer the question and when they don't have to answer the question. Or because there's been a lot of back and forth of like, you know, you do not have to volunteer your status to a law enforcement officer. What can you tell people about their rights? And then also let us know the investigative path that officers can take. Can you help us understand both those things?
Sure, I'll do my best. So as of right now, local law enforcement does not have immigration investigative authority. Maybe I misworded a little. That doesn't mean they can't ask a question.
Okay.
It just means they can't conduct an immigration-based investigation. So in most cases, a trooper that comes across someone they suspect may be illegal is from a simple traffic stop or a moving violation of some type. They're not out looking for immigration violations. It's more of a opportunity, more of another tool they can use if they do in the normal course of their business. So when they're stopped, it's the same as if you're stopped for any other moving vehicle violation. You have the same rights, same privileges. And the trooper has to build a reasonable suspicion case,
sure,
to then conduct an immigration-type investigation. And they look for key indicators, just like they would with when they're looking for drug dealers and people hauling drugs. You know, there are certain states that will issue a driver's license to anybody. There are certain – Minnesota, for instance, will issue a vehicle registration to a person who is a resident of Sioux Falls. So you can stop a Minnesota-plated vehicle and with a Sioux Falls address and you're a South Dakota resident. When you see that, that's suspicious. Why would someone do that? So there's those types of indicators that they look for, which then can lead them to a certain path of questioning and then get to that point where they're asking those specific immigration questions.
So pulling somebody over for speeding, for example, mm-hmm, and highway patrol officers do more than that. It's just I'm most likely to have been encountered with them if I was speeding on the highway. Accident investigation would be another common connection point between a community member and a highway patrol officer in an accident. Because what I'm getting at here, Secretary, is also this idea that the criticism of this program is that it erodes public trust and that maybe somebody won't call you if they're, you know, have a flat tire or they have an accident, that they might not make the phone call because they've lost a little bit of trust. And so help us understand how you build trust with the community and then also train your troopers to have this extra duty of immigration work that they're doing.
Sure. I think interviews like this help build that trust. I'm expressing to you that it's not their focus. They're not out there looking for illegal immigrants. It's more as they come across someone. The question about whether someone might call or not if they're in an accident and they're here illegally, I don't know that I have a good answer for that. I mean, if they're here illegally and they have a criminal background, there's most likely going to be consequences to that if the trooper picks up on it. I will say, and I think this is important, we've had instances already just recently, just because you're stopped and the trooper determines you're not here legally doesn't mean you're getting arrested. When they reach out to ICE, ICE has parameters, metrics they look at. If you have no criminal history, if you have a somewhat verifiable permanent residence, maybe you have a job, we ran into some the other day who were with their employer doing work out west. When ICE got called, they're like, okay, we'll investigate that at a later time. No need to take them into custody now. So we're not everybody that gets stopped who we determine to be here illegally are going to get arrested. So I think that's important for the community to know. Those people that are here working for a living, that doesn't mean I can't guarantee no one will ever. It's up to ICE. But that's not the focus of ICE and certainly not the focus of the highway patrol troopers who will be exercising these additional tools.
Yeah. Other things that you're measuring, does the agreement have a reporting requirement? Like, how will we know that the Highway Patrol is using this authority? Like, the Attorney General's office was like, we're going to let you know the high profile cases for sure, where we've used this authority to remove somebody in the way that the Attorney General has decided DCI will. Are there public, you know, are you revealing things publicly or are you reporting them in some kind of open government way so people know how often the Highway Patrol is using this authority?
That's an excellent question. I don't know that we've fully vetted that out yet. Of course, we keep track of everything we do from a traffic ticket to a 287G stop. How that may or may not be shared, I don't have a good answer right now. I know that I'm feeding it to the governor's office or whoever wants to know how they may use that or how we may disseminate that in the future. As you know, we don't generally do that with any other crime either, unless it's a big deal like the 200 pounds of meth. But you don't hear about all of the other traffic stops where we see some smaller volume of drugs.
Yeah.
So it's not something we generally do. I would assume we're going to follow that same path.
Have you already used the authority? Have there already been cases?
there have been several cases already, but the troopers didn't yet have the authority. They came across it some other way. It became obvious to them some other way. And at that point, it's not like they can't still conduct an investigation without the training that they would normally investigate otherwise. Many of the same steps you take for drug trafficking or transporting drugs are the same. I mean, you're going to ask questions, and you're going to gain suspicion, and then you're going to make a determination of what you have. But right now, well, the troopers are trained now, but it was just this week they all got finished. So prior to that, it's strictly a call to ICE like it has been historically, and you have to follow
if there was a criminal thing, and if there was something like a drug case, and then you would find out that person was
correct.
Also did not have legal status.
Right.
So how are you measuring success for the program?
I think looking at it that way isn't quite correct, because it's not like we're trying to create a goal of how many of these can we get. That's not the goal.
Nobody
at
is
all.
Pressuring you to hit
no.
a quota.
No, not at all. It's a tool, because quite frankly, troopers are frustrated, or law enforcement generally are frustrated previously when they would come across a criminal illegal alien, someone with a criminal history who may or may not be some continuing danger to the community, and then ICE has no way, there's just no one here from ICE to do anything about it. Now with this tool, troopers, or the state so far, only troopers and DCI agents, will have a tool to help ICE remove those criminal aliens that, you know, potentially can have a continuing danger to society.
Any other misperceptions about this? That one of the things I was wondering, and it came up in this this large arrest that you mentioned with so much meth in the car, and not that specific person who was driving the car, but in general, it had me wondering who has the authority between you and the DCI. Or, you know, the Attorney General and you, are you working together? Because Attorney General Jackley said, you know, we might remove somebody rather than go through the prosecution and the expense here, and he would be making those decisions. And then I started wondering, like, do you have decision-making, and how do you connect with him and work with his office? You see what I'm kind of getting at there?
Yeah,
it's
I
a little
do.
Muddy
I understand
to me.
Exactly
yeah.
what you're getting
okay.
at.
Yeah.
And that's an important distinction, as I discussed. The trooper's role and their priorities and their job, basically, is very different than a DCI agent. So troopers don't decide who gets prosecuted. They don't decide, you know, that type of thing. That's where DCI is different. The Highway Patrol is going to find them. They're going to follow the guidance given to them. We may call a DCI agent out to assist for the criminal side of the investigation like we would in the 200 pounds of meth. So those decisions about whether the path follows deportation rather than arrest or prosecution would be up to the state's attorneys or the attorney general.
Thank you. That clears that up. About that 207 pounds, regular traffic stop, that's a speeding call, and the Highway Patrol officer, tell me a story.
So, yes. Basic
from
speeding
a law
arrest.
Enforcement standpoint, that's a big thing to stumble upon.
Yes, young
for
trooper,
an officer
very
solo.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to say too much. It's in the prosecutive stage, but
sure, fair, yeah.
Once the person was stopped for speeding, like you said, it was a speeding stop. There were some pretty obvious indicators that something was up, both visually and through the conversation during the stop. I don't want to say more than that.
Sure. Yeah, no, I don't want to put anything in jeopardy as that proceeds. That's a career, that's a memorable experience
yes.
for that officer.
Yes,
do you
absolutely.
Have backup? How quickly does backup come? Like, my impression of troopers is they work often by themselves at great distances from one another.
Usually that's correct, but this was right in the middle of the city of Sturgis during the rally. There were troopers everywhere.
That's Public Safety Secretary Bob Perry of the state of South Dakota. He shared how South Dakota's Highway Patrol partnership with ICE will work. You can find our other conversations about 287G partnerships on our website, sdpb.org. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. I'm Lori Walsh. From all of us here at SDPB, we thank you for listening.